Takunda, welcome to Africa State of Mind. Thank you very much for joining us on today's episode.
Awesome.
I really hope that you know, something funny is not going to happen and the whole back end or the before, the preview, should I say, of this conversation doesn't
spill over.
Doesn't spill over, because you know, I have a reputation to protect. Thank you very much for joining us.
Cool. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So we're basically going to talk about the business of comedy, funny business, making money, and, you know, just the history where that's concerned.
Yeah.
Just a quick thing.
Yeah.
You were behind Pierre Monati's show as well, right?
Yeah, I was the producer on the second season.
Yeah.
It was two seasons.
Yeah.
And I came in. And I mean, funny enough, that was my introduction to the world of comedy.
Yeah.
Before I had graduated from Varsity with a BCom degree majoring in law.
Mm-hmm.
And I think halfway through my degree, I realized, like, my dad always wanted to be a lawyer and he never became one. And halfway through, I was just like, hang on a minute.
This is not going to happen.
I think I'm basically living out somebody else's dream.
Yeah.
Because, like, I mean, I enjoyed it, but I was just like, I'm not passionate about it.
Yeah.
So when I got my degree, I was like, instead of carrying on with the whole LLB thing, I was like, let me actually just go out there in the world and see, you know, find something that I'm passionate about.
Mm-hmm.
And it's while I was in the wilderness, I did like a lot of project management and stuff like that. And then long story is a long story how I ended up in TV. But basically, I became the producer of the Pierre Monati show without having
let us not even forget that show is legendary.
No, absolutely. It's
not
cult.
Even we don't even
cult.
Say was, we say is.
No, you absolutely know? To this day
and
David Kao still have people saying, when is PMS coming back?
Yes,
when is PMS coming back?
Yeah.
At some point it was the bane of Kagiso's existence because he just felt like he hadn't done anything else.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? No, but it was a huge privilege to work on that.
Yeah.
And I think for me, even more so, because before that I hadn't even as much as produced a wedding video or like a
and now here you are on like
nothing.
The biggest show,
you know what I mean? And the thing is, you know, it's crazy though, it's like while you're in it, you know, you don't know. You know, when you look back and you're like, wow, we did something incredibly amazing and we shifted the paradigm in comedy in this country, you know? But while you're doing it, you know what I mean? You're just doing it, you know? You're just sort of like, hey, let's do this show and this is what we think we should do and this feels right. And, you know, we made decisions based on just instinct and you're just going with it.
Yeah.
But then after the fact, you look back and you're like, oh, wow.
It's amazing.
You know?
It's always 2020, I guess that's the term, where it's only much later when you're like, oh my gosh.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And for me, it was just like, I was like, wow, this is a cool gig. Let me just make sure that I don't lose it, you know, because I had no experience.
Yeah.
And I mean, Kagiso is the exec producer and he took a huge
risk.
Gamble on me. You know?
So I have to tell you something funny. I was actually on one of the episodes of Pierre Monati show by default.
But that's pretty much everybody's story.
Yeah, everyone's story. Like, you just got it was Kagiso called, and then David Chibuka called, and I was like, they're like, just show up at Mike's Kitchen in Parktown North. And I said, okay.
Yeah.
And then I had
What's
a flower in my
here?
Head, and I was on a date, but I wasn't on a date. And I was just like, bro, what is happening?
I remember that. But if you pull out all the footage, all the episodes, you know, from both season one and two, and you actually go through like the people who sort of were in the sketches, I think everybody from like DJ Fresh to like
everybody was
featured in some way or form. But it was the kind of show as well, because it was sketch comedy and it was like, it was a show that didn't take itself so seriously. We like everyone in the crew, like everyone from our DOP to like the sound guy, continuity lady, everybody was in some sketch. I remember being the producer and I came on set and they were having problems. They needed I also was playing rugby in those days, so I was like quite buff, and they're having problem with the sketch where this construction worker is gay, but he hadn't come out, and you know, he was on this construction site all buff and in, like, you know what I mean, like a vest or whatever, and the guy they had gotten just couldn't get his lines right, you know. So I just came on set on that day just to check on how everything was going on or whatever. Cut to half an hour later, was I not the gay construction worker in the sketch? And to this day, people like either like remember me from like working with Trevor and Ed and all these guys, or they're like, hey, you're the gay construction worker on PMS.
And like,
I was also the producer. I was just, you know what I mean?
I just happened to be there.
It was one of those.
Yeah.
So.
But I guess that's how, I mean, I imagine that that's how shows that are internationally known, like in Living Color, I just imagine that
absolutely.
That is how that all happened.
Absolutely. And sketch comedy really has a sort of rhythm of its own. Mm. It's really special because there's, I wouldn't say it's improv because obviously everything's scripted and so forth, but it just gives you so much room to express. So if you're an actor, or actress, or you're a comedian, like it's almost like you are able to really sort of just express yourself and be free, rather than, because you know, if you're doing drama or whatever, you know, there's a storyline and the character has to stay in character. Whereas if you're telling a 3-minute sketch and it's a 3-minute story, you can just be whoever you want in that, you know.
So now let's start, we should have actually started with this. So you said that you wanted to that you were studying law and your dad was meant to be a lawyer and then he didn't. So I guess because your story,
if you ever listen to this, you'd just be like, why are you putting my stuff,
why are you putting
streets?
Me out there, you know, because we learn it from our parents, I'm telling you. So where are you from originally? Where's your family from?
So originally from Zimbabwe.
Okay, so education is a huge thing. That's where I'm getting
at. No, full on. So it was proper, like, and I was fortunate enough. I went to a very good sort of private school in Zim, and I was playing rugby and all of those things, and I was like sort of first black hair boy of my school. And
Just
those times. you know what I mean? But so there was a lot of like, wow, this kid's gonna be something.
It's gonna be something.
Do something. Yeah. You know? And I remember I got a scholarship, a rugby scholarship, to go study and play rugby in New Zealand.
Oh, wow.
Which, you know,
that's pretty,
it's huge,
that's
right?
A huge thing, yeah.
But my parents were just like, you know, and when I told them, I thought they were like, wow. In my mind, I was like, at the very least, guys, you don't have to pay for my university fees. Mm. Like, it's that.
But African parents
know. And then they were like, and then play rugby. Explain to us more. And I was just like, yeah, it's great. It's New Zealand. And then they're like, you know what? New Zealand's not going anywhere. Rugby's not going anywhere. You know, university. You know, you spoke about BCom. That's what you're doing. Let's sort that out first. And then we can, you know.
Talk about
so, yeah, it was all education. Heavy, you know. And I was even, like, I was playing rugby for UCT and doing really well. But they were just like, oh, how's... It's almost like you're playing sports. That's nice.
That's nice, yeah.
But,
But I think that African parents, that's the thing. It's like they're all like...
Hold on.
Oh, that's so good. Yeah. So what did you get in the, you know, it's always one of those things.
Is it because of your rugby?
Is it because of this? And you had to be really careful. Now, so you said the Pio Minati show was your first
foray into comedy.
Into comedy, you know. And you've had an extensive career where you've managed some of the biggest names in comedy in South Africa, including my cousin. You know, who was the first person that you managed and how did that come about?
So I think it's weird because it's Kagiso Lediga and Loiso Gola were the first people. Because basically, cut to 2015, the Pio Minati show had just, his second season had just finished. And we were having issues. Well, the SABC was having issues with us. Because if you watch that show, it was like nothing else on TV. Yeah. It was fire. It was like... There was no sacred cows. We were going all in. And in 2005, not 2015. And in 2005, it's like 10 years after, like, you know, the elections and democracy. And it's a brand new country. The country was 10 years old. And then you have all these guys on TV, like, you know what I mean? Putting on masks and doing Nelson Mandela impersonations and dressing up guys and, you know, pretending to be Zelda, you know, like... It was too much too soon, almost. You know what I mean? Mm. Although in our minds was like, this is exactly what we needed, you know? Mm. After just like the heaviness of apartheid and, you know, everything else, like we felt like a show that really just sort of like gave social commentary or spoke about the country we're in from a different angle is what we needed. But I mean, the powers that be at the SABC were like, this is too much. You guys, this is great. As we're like, okay, fine.
It was highly rated.
We're like, okay, fine. You might not like our content and whatever, but look at these ratings, though. You know what I mean? Like going through the roof. And they kept pushing us out. Like, I think initially we were like at 8, then they pushed us out to like 9, and then they pushed us out to 10 because they're like, whoa. And still, our ratings were just like,
crazy,
you know? And they were like, your ratings might be great. People might be enjoying it, but this is too much. So that's when they canned the Pio Minati show. Because so many people still were like, why did you guys get taken off type vibes? So we're all like, what do we do now? And the irony of it is that we were all so young. And even though we had achieved so much with the show, in terms of other opportunities, everybody was like, oh, but, you know, we can't give you guys other shows because you're so young and you're so inexperienced. But we're like, but how are we going to be experienced if you don't give us opportunity to do more content or produce, you know? So that's when these comedians, and it's also because I'd been working on, I was like, all these comedians were all young and amazing and doing really, really, they were all so talented, but they didn't have a business model to what they were doing. And also back then, there was no like black manager, black agencies or anything like that. But yet all the talent that was coming through were all like young black talent. Mm. So the only comedy agencies or management companies or people doing that kind of stuff were people who had existed even before 95. So all the guys were like, and I used to just hang out with all the comedians and people like, are you, no, I'm not a comedian, but I'm a producer. So then Kakiso and Loiso actually were like, dude, why don't you, and no, and then I went up to them and said, guys, if I opened a comedy agency, would you come on board? Would you join me? Because, I mean, I don't have money. I'm like 25 and I'm rolling with you guys. I'm getting drunk on the streets with you guys. I don't, you know what I mean? I don't have money. I don't have experience, but I have a feeling that I, you know, we could do something. So the guys are like, yeah, do it. Because, I mean, no one's managing us, so you might as well. Type vibes, you know? And I remember Kakiso would be like, at least there'll be a reason why you're at my house. Because you're at my house all the time anyway.
At least now we have a...
At least there's a reason, you know? Anyway, but I mean, jokes aside, I was like, in my mind, I was like, I think there's something that could be done here. Because this talent is wasted, but it's not being channeled. So on hope and a prayer, really, you know, I set up a podium and... Literally, Kakiso and Lois were my first artists.
That's quite a big... those are quite big names to have as your first artist.
But when you look back now...
Yes.
I mean, when you look at them now, you're like, wow, look at these guys. They're huge. But back then, Loi was this kid out of Googs who had never had a gig except for, you know, working at a petrol station as a petrol attendant. And he was like out there, like, you know, proper hip-hop, baggy jeans.
Yeah.
And then he'd get on stage and he was just like hectic and... rowdy,
yeah, and he talented, used to hang out with the wrong people, because I knew, because even in hip hop I was just like, Luis, I'm just like, some of the people that you're around, they're like really thugs. They're like really
though, because like, I mean, that's where he comes from. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? And it's I mean, this is the reality. And I think a lot of people also was people who had tried to manage him,
they couldn't. Yeah.
He's young, black, angry, hip hop. You know what I mean?
Who happens to be a comedian too.
Why are you telling me what I can or cannot say on stage? You know? Like, they struggled with that. Whereas with me, because not to say I came from Guguletu, but I could relate with who he was, where he came from, also like raised by his mom, you know, that kind of vibe. And literally, if he hadn't left Googs when he did, you know what I mean?
The story would probably have ended
completely different, right? So look, and so they took a chance. I took a chance on them. They took a chance on me, you know? And also because we'd worked on PMS, I got their personalities and characters. But the one thing that I also say to myself, I was like, I'm not going to, you know, and was sort of the philosophy of my approach over the next 10 years that I ran Podium was like, just because other management companies in South Africa are doing X, Y, and Z doesn't mean that we must follow suit. I was like, we're young, we're starting from scratch. I've got these young guys who are like, you know, have taken a chance on me. Let's do this differently. Let's approach it differently. And I also sort of said, let's look at the established comedy markets in the world. Let's look at the States. Let's look at the UK. Let's look at what... You know, what is their track record of like, how are artists managed there? How have they built all these brands, you know? And also back then, you know, Chris Rock and Eddie Murphy and those guys were just like shining lights in comedy, you know, and they're young black guys. So we're like, so in my mind, I was like, let me use that as a reference. Let me look at Def Comedy Jam. Let me look at that and see if we can replicate that or learn or, you know, take the page out of that book and see if we could do it here, you know? So the one thing also at that time was that there was no real management of comedians per se. There were like these booking agents. So these booking agents had like 30, 40, 50, 60 artists on their books. And it wasn't just comedians, it was like musicians, jugglers, whatever. Because the whole model was a commission model. It was almost like, because they got, that's how you got paid, you know? But if you have a commission model, there's only one of two ways you can make money. Either A, it's volume. So if you have 100 people in your books and you're getting like 10, 20% commission on 100 people, you're going to make money.
You're going to make money.
Right? Alternatively, you could only have 3, 4, 5 people in your books, but then these guys are making serious cash.
So, that so it's
even
enough.
If you're making, you know what I mean? And at that time, because comedy was so small, not many people believe that you could have real comedy superstars. I mean, David Kahn, those guys were starting to make huge strides, but no one was like massive, massive, you know? So I was like, in my mind, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to build brands. I'm not going to manage comedians. I'm going to build brands. I'm going to build their brands around their unique personalities. Because also, David Kibuka is very different to Loiso Gola, who's very different to Kagiso Lodika, who's very different to Trevor Noah, who's very different to Eugene Khoza, you know? So I was like, tapped into who they were, and like, we're going to build a brand around you, you know? And we're going to build everything that you do will speak of your truth. So like Trevor, for example, you know? He was always that clean-cut, you know what I mean? Like, you know, charming, smooth. So we were like, that's your brand. And people are going to see you in suits. People are going to see you.
That's where you are.
That's your vibe, you know? Loy, like, you're brash, you're outspoken, you know? You're going to be the voice of the young people. That's your brand. That's your vibe, you know? And if people see you wearing Converse, you know, people will be like, yeah, that's right on brand, that's Loy. But on the back of that, Converse might have paid you money to be wearing their shoes.
Exactly, yeah.
And I just sort of brought that sort of, because of my also BCom background, whatever, that sort of business approach, you know? And every year it was like, we'll run this agency for a year, and at the end of the year,
and
we'll
how many,
see if
and
we're
you
still
here. You ran it for
10 years.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
So now I want to talk a bit about just, you know, the history of comedy in South Africa, and especially that particular era, because as you're speaking, I just keep remembering, I just keep thinking about how, as comedy was kind of, especially, let me say, black comedians in South Africa were really out there, and it was led by the younger people and everything. The same thing was happening with the hip-hop movement.
Absolutely.
They actually moved, you know, parallel.
Parallel.
It was literally like a parallel, and the two played off each other. You know, there was this huge understanding.
Sure.
So what are your thoughts about where comedy was then versus where we are now?
So I mean, I could speak for like 2 hours on that, you know, on that question. I think the parallels of, you're very right, because I kind of feel where hip hop and comedy are so, so similar, and in many ways related to each other, is that they've always been a genre of expression of, and also an expression, you know, from the, either sort of the marginalized or, you know, persecuted, or, you know, if you've got something to say, and especially when you've got something to say, when you've got a truth to say to power, you know, hip hop and comedy have always been great avenues to do that. So, especially in South Africa, I mean, with our checkered past and where we come from, there was a lot to say, you know, and I kind of feel like, you know, that's why there were so many similarities in how those two genres evolved in South Africa. And I think, especially at the beginning, like, it's not to say before 95 comedy didn't exist. It existed, but to a very, it was
very limited and niche.
Because I always say to people, and I've done like a lot of interviews with, like, you know, international media institutions and stuff, and I always explain it this way, is that for comedy to exist and for comedy to thrive, right, there's certain fundamentals that need to be in place. So the freedoms, should I say, so like freedom of expression needs to be, like, you know, celebrated or acknowledged or whatever, freedom of movement, freedom of just all sorts of things that apartheid wouldn't allow, like, you know, and like everything that comedy stands for, apartheid stood against that. You know what I mean? Like, even just freedom of movement, like, you know, the ability to be able to go, and then gathering, people being able to gather and so forth. Like, these are all things that comedy needs. And during sort of the environment that apartheid had created, there was no freedom of expression. There was no freedom of movement. There was no freedom of, like, sort of people engaging and so forth. So comedy couldn't exist for the broader, you know, populace, if you want to put it that way. But the comedy that was happening were the people who were allowed to do it. So it was like this tiny thing happening in some weird corner. But the greatest thing about comedy, and this is not just a South African thing, is that across the continent, comedy has always been part of our...
It's part of the DNA.
Our DNA. Yeah. And yes. I always explain to people this way, that, you know, people always say comedy comes from pain. And not many people are able to understand that, you know? But it's almost like that whole thing of, if you understand what it's like to live in abject poverty, or to struggle, or to suffer, if you understand, if you've been on the extreme spectrum of that emotion, when you experience something on the opposite end of that spectrum, you appreciate it so much more than someone who hasn't suffered or experienced injustice or whatever. So people, I always say to people, like in Africa, we don't laugh like just with our mouths. We laugh with our entire bodies, you know, and we all know, like when you're in the hood or in a family gathering and there's just comedy going down, people are like jumping up and down or like, do you know what I mean? We are expressive that way. Mm. So the thing is, when what happened sort of post, you know, 95 is that comedy came from, it was happening in our homes, in our streets, in the church or in the taxi. But now there was also now an opportunity to actually, like, you know, do it as a profession, as a thing that you did to make money and pay your bills and look after your family. So, but that transition took a long time because, even as we were talking earlier, you know, if you told your parents, I want to be a comedian, they'll be like, what? They want to tell jokes.
You want to be a clown.
You want to, exactly. Yes. I mean, you can tell jokes to your friends, that's fine. Yeah. But can you just do your finance degree and get that, you know what I mean? So, and that took a while for that mindset, for that thing to change, you know? And I think to a large extent, the successes of things like the Pure Minati show, even like Fat Joe show, and then all the other sort of comedy related sort of content that was, you know, out there, started making people look at comedy differently, you know? And I've always said I've been really privileged to have been involved in comedy at a time like I was, because I literally saw this whole evolution take place, you know, from the guys being the, you know, comedians being the sort of the court jesters in the entertainment industry, you know, where people are like, oh, those are clowns, man. We're out here making
the
money.
Industry.
To now when Trevor is now commanding the most respect globally as an African entertainer, you know. So
I wanted to talk a little bit about this, you know. I think her name is Michelle Wolf.
Yes.
Who did the White House correspondence dinner, and who was just I was in stitches. Yeah, that was so funny.
She's amazing.
So you know, when you look at people like her, and then, you know, other Nigerian comedians like Basket Mouth and so forth, you know, and then you look at what Trevor's doing in general, and then when you're talking about how before, you know, during apartheid, there wasn't the opportunity where you could freely express yourself in a public spectrum like that, where people could gather and everything. But now, with the way the world is going, it almost feels as though politics and what's going on with politics and leaders really shapes what is happening in comedy as a whole. It's quite absolutely. It's quite interesting. So even the way, you know, comedians will go after Robert Mugabe, for example, it really does feel like that. I mean, even Museveni now, I have should not even be talking. You know, so what sort of role, based on those kind of examples and what Michelle Wolf spoke about, and, you know, her comedy, her presentation at the White House Correspondents' Dinner and such. And then Trevor also does a lot of commentary about what's going on in Africa, the comparison between the American president and African, you know, dictators, which is hilarious.
Yeah.
So what do you think comedy's role is in the political sphere? Because it almost feels like it's become so important.
Absolutely. So I kind of feel like, for starters, I'll start with just one line and then I'll go back to, you know, so essentially think of it this way. It's almost like comedy and stroke comedians are essentially the voice of the people in many ways. It's they're just literally expressing what people are thinking and feeling and talking about, you know. So comedians become like a mouthpiece for society, you know, and to make commentary about basically anything that's happening. But if you go way back, right, to the sort of origins of you know, comedy, almost as a stage thing or whatever, and I'll use an example. So, for example, remember, like with the kings and queens, the time of kings and queens in England and so forth, you know, nobody could say anything to the king or to the queen. Except. Nobody. Except the court jester.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
And the court jester, and it was a tricky path as well, because if the court jester took it too far, you know, then that's him. That's him or her. That's your life gone. But to a large extent, if you were funny and you are smart about your funny, you could get away with it. If the king was laughing at what you're saying, you know, even if it's a bottom, if somebody's laughing, they can't be angry. They can't. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
So in many ways, that's the role that comedy has always been able to play, is to almost like you know, pick up a mirror and show it at society, you know? And if the person who's communicating the message, you know, is a great comedian, but also smart comedian, and they're able to speak about things without being overly offensive or whatever the case may be, because you're laughing, it opens your mind up and you know what I mean? You can't be angry in a moment of laughter. Mm-hmm. You can only be open-minded.
Yes.
So in many ways, with these leaders and political leaders and politics, where many people can't say, you know, certain things to a Donald Trump or a Robert Mugabe or, you know, Survey or whatever, a smart comedian who can make people laugh can do that and get away with it. Yes. And that's the beauty of laughter. Mm. You know, I always say, like, laughter is truly the world's universal language.
Yes,
because no matter where you are on this earth, you know, you laugh.
Mm.
You all have that feeling. A baby laughs before they can talk. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so it's a powerful, powerful medium.
Mm.
And it's able to sort of traverse and navigate places where other genres can't, you know? So in terms of satire, specifically when it's, you know, given that context, obviously, then comedy is a great way of speaking truth to power.
Mm.
And I've always said to comedians, because people say, yeah, but can you talk about everything? Can you make jokes? Yeah. You can pretty much do jokes on anything.
Mm.
As long as you do it smartly and as long as there's a level of intelligence. So even if somebody's like laughing, they're like, I disagree with you, but I see where you're coming from. That's where you want
to
be.
It opens you up to almost be, you know, to see everything from both sides of the aisle.
Absolutely.
So to speak.
Absolutely. So yeah, so satire, and I think, you know, these are crazy times we're living in.
Mm-hmm.
And not just because of what's happening there in America and the White House
even
with that guy,
but
on the continent and everywhere else. And because of that, comedy has really sort of come to the fore in many ways because that's become the strongest, one of the strongest ways that society can speak, you know, through these comedians. And, you know.
So now, talking about the continent, there are a few comedians that I just think are hilarious. So Kansiime Ann, not because she's Ugandan, but she is funny and she's amazing, she's doing really well.
Yeah.
We've got Churchill in Kenya, who is also, I mean, he's funny when you're around him. He's a walking clown.
Yeah.
I mean, that with the most respect. You know, and then there's Basket Mouth as well, who's selling out, you know, around from the UK, Nigeria, everything. And then AY has got his movies and everything that he's doing, you know.
Yeah.
And then there's Eddie Cardi, Congo, who's also, you know. So
I really like him.
He's
amazing.
So now, what are your views on where African comedy is? Yeah. And I ask this question because we're seeing with regards to, and obviously Trevor's doing really well and such. So we're seeing, with popular culture globally, Africa's kind of taken center stage. So
absolutely.
From the musicians to representation in movies and everything, where do you see African comedy in comparison to the rest of the world, or what's our stake in the world, or what could it be?
Well, I think to a large extent, I mean, for me, and my thing I live for now in terms of comedy is like everything that I do now, or I'm doing and I plan to do, is I will not rest until African comedy, you know, gets its rightful place at the international comedy table.
Mm.
And we're not there, not because of a lack of talent or lack of, you know what I mean? It's just we haven't been in the mix. We just haven't been, you know, it's that kind of like, there's a great party happening and you just didn't get the invite, you know? It's not to say you're not out there being amazing and, you know, deserve to be. We just haven't been in the mix.
Mm.
And I kind of feel like I'm so thrilled about what Trevor has done, not just for him, but just almost as an example of what African comedy is capable of.
Exactly.
And he's not the only example. Mm. He's just an example.
Example, yes.
And an example of what's to come. I really believe that. So in terms of African comedy, over the past sort of 5 years, the one thing that I started doing was traveling with comedy. And I was traveling all over the continent. And it's crazy because not many people, and maybe it's because I'm originally from Zimbabwe, so I have a different outlook, you know, on Africa. And so I started doing a lot of travel in the continent, especially at a time when it wasn't fashionable.
Because now it's in fashion.
When it wasn't Africanacity, you know what I mean? And I was out there, and I like, for example, the first time I watched Basket Mouth performing
he's funny.
Was in Lagos.
Was it an Echo Hotel?
I flew myself because I was like, I want to see.
Because
you watch it on YouTube and, you know, and these like two things involved jokes and all that kind of stuff. And I was like, yo, dude, can I come watch you?
Yeah.
And he was like, you just want to come watch? And I was like, yeah.
Yeah.
Can I?
Bovi's cool? Funny too.
If you give me a ticket, I'll come through.
Yes.
And literally paid my way to go see. Because I was like, I want to see it for myself. And I did the same with, like, in Uganda, where there's an amazing scene with, like, Patrick Salvador and all those guys.
Yes, Salvador, how could I forget?
Amazing.
He's amazing. Yes,
yes. And Anne Kansiime and all these people. And I started just traveling on my own will, you know. And every now and again, my guys would get booked to do gigs. Like, Kagiso went and did MTV stuff in Nigeria, or Lloyd getting booked to go perform in Zambia, all that kind of stuff. And what I realized very quickly, it was just like, it may be very raw and it may not be very polished, but the level of comedy across this continent is phenomenal. Mm. And I said it also in context of, I started traveling to all the biggest comedy festivals all over the world, like going to New York, which is like a mecca for comedy, London, going to Sydney, Australia, going to all these places. And, you know, people say, you got to see this comedian, he's amazing. And I'll watch him and I'll be like, I see, he's funny, but I can tell you at least 10 comedians from South Africa who would like destroy this guy, but you just don't know about them.
So what do you think needs to happen for what do you think needs to change in order for this to happen?
Well, I think the change is already happening. Okay. So I think to a large extent, what has been a massive, massive sort of thing that's going to change the paradigm is just the internet, you know, the world has never been more connected than it is now. Mm. And what's starting to happen is that people are starting to, you know, be, and comedy has always been about American comedy culture and history, British comedy culture and history, and to a certain extent, Australians and New Zealand. But outside of that, no one even knew comedy existed beyond those markets. Mm. What's starting to happen now is because people have got the internet and you can load up your content or whatever, people are starting to be exposed to comedy from all over the world. And also, to a large extent, with respect, like, we've consumed so much American comedy, so much British comedy, that it's so refreshing to see good comedy from somewhere else.
Yeah.
So, for example, Trevor, one of the main reasons he's exploded is because they'd never seen a comedian like him, a perspective like his, and, you know, just basically they'd never heard comedies told like that.
And he actually, what I like about what Trevor does on The Daily Show, and even before when he was traveling, is that he really tells, how do I say, he really, to use a hip hop term, which I'm trying to not, he really keeps it real.
Yeah, yeah.
With regards to telling comedy that is, he kind of brings the world into what is happening in Africa. And I think that that's quite unique, the way, because he's opening it up. When he draws comparisons with the two different worlds and the two, you know, what's happening, it really, what he does is that he opens it up for everybody else.
Absolutely.
Which I think is quite good. Now, in Nigeria, I think for me, when I'm in Nigeria and Uganda, I'm not just saying because I'm Ugandan, but I feel like every conversation feels as though it is just a comedic experience.
Absolutely.
I can think of 1,000 times I talk to my dad and I'm just like, Daddy, how did we get here? Like, why are we talking, you know?
So funny.
And it's so, you know, that whole thing. Yeah. So, you know, so everything feels like that. But what I do also realize and recognize a lot, so in Nigeria, there are very specific things that are very specifically Nigerian.
Sure.
So if you're in Nigeria, you'll call somebody a goat. And that doesn't mean greatest of all time. That is the insult of life.
Proper.
It's like,
yeah, goat.
Goat.
Yeah.
You know, it's like done. And then in Uganda,
broken,
you know,
down,
when Anne is talking and everything, her jokes are also very localized to Uganda. And, you know, Nigeria, a lot of the Nigerian jokes are very localized to Nigeria. But they're still exploding around the world.
Yeah.
What are your views on the stories that you tell about where it is that you're from, and also the language factor when it comes to comedy?
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, I'll start with that. When you're like, you know, sometimes when you're in these places, like, you know, Nigeria and Ghana or Uganda, it feels like it's just
everything.
It's a comedy fest. But you know what it is as well, which also is very uniquely, I feel, in many ways, thing that connects us all as Africans, is that comedy is actually a survival mechanism. To a large extent. Mm. So when we were talking earlier about it's in our DNA. Part of that is like, if you don't laugh about like our
you're gonna be miserable. And you'll probably die.
You're gonna be miserable, right?
Yes.
So when we hold on to comedy, we hold on to that because sometimes it's the only thing that gets us through.
Mm.
Sometimes, you know what I mean? Because there's a lot of like stuff to depress you or make you miserable on the continent. You like Lagos, like I was saying to Basketball Mouth, I was like, bruh, this place looks like a dump sometimes. Like, you walk, do you know what I mean?
Like, where are you at? Are you on the island, the mainland? Where,
but what makes the place, people always say the energy in Lagos, energy in Nigeria is crazy. You know what? Where it comes from? It comes from the people. Mm. So they have to rise beyond their circumstance or condition or whatever the case may be. So we hold on to that. So, and that's why I really believe this. In the future, like, you know, especially if this whole thing of comedy comes from pain. Guys, this continent, we have
pain.
And continue to experience. You know, so if comedy comes from pain, we are a massive factory for comedy. Yeah, you know, we just need to package it and take it to the rest of the world. So, which takes me to the point you're asking now, is that then how is it transferable? You know, how do we? So the thing is, obviously, to a large extent, you know, you're gonna do comedy. Your initial comedy you're going to do is going to be your immediate environment, what's happening around you, right? But I think what's starting to happen with a lot of African comedians, they're starting to realize is that their story, maybe not necessarily the very specific gags, you know, but their story and where they come from is worthy to, you know, it's a story that's worthy to be told, you know? And we used, like Trevor, when Trevor first went to the States, and where I give kudos, people don't realize this about Trevor. He didn't just land there. He didn't just end up on
Did he almost lose everything?
He literally said, I've made this X amount of money. I've been putting it aside. I'm going to go to the States. I'm going to give myself a year to make it.
Yes.
If I don't make it in a year, I'll come back, make more money, and then go back until I make it. And he spent those flight tickets and accommodation and being on the subway every day and all that kind of stuff. That was him investing in himself. He spent, you know what I mean? Like scrambling. And what he found at the beginning, because in his mind, he was like, I've grown up in American comedy. I can assimilate and become one of them. And in many ways, he almost tried to become African-American. You know what I mean? In terms of what he was trying to do. Because he was like, clearly, that's what I need to do to fit in. And it wasn't working out so well. But I think the big realization he got sort of a couple of months in, because everybody would be like, he would come off stage and whether he did well or not or whatever, people are like, cool. But so are you from Africa? Like proper Africa? Tell us about that. You know, what do you guys roll with, like animals in the streets or is it just a fabrication or, you know what I mean? So he realized very quickly that him being, his difference was the unique thing about him. It made him different to every other comedian that was out there. And it's not to say he embraced being African because it was the commercial. What he realized that actually,
this is what people want to hear.
Yes. And they want to hear my perspective on politics as an African, not as an African American or an American.
From
the outside in. Yes. And that made him, and also because he's an amazing comedian and he's an amazing performer and, you know, he can write gags. That guy can churn out material like nothing I've ever seen. But that uniqueness, that difference of opinion and that difference of like background or whatever made him stand apart. And he embraced it. And he was like, okay, do you know what I mean? I just have to be me. And so his gags were either like, this, I'm from Africa and this is how we are different to you. Or I'm from Africa and this here, what you're doing here, this is how crazy it is for me, you know? So he'll do jokes like, you know, there's Duane Reade Pharmacies, there's that massive franchise chain or whatever. And in some places, the thing has got like, it's a 3-floor pharmacy. And he's like, guys, you guys diss us because we got AIDS and we got Ebola and we got all this stuff. You know what I mean? But we don't have 3-story pharmacies.
No.
Like, what's going on with you guys? You know what I mean? Like, exactly. So it was, and they laughed and they never thought of that because from in their world, Duane Reade has got 3 stories. You know, he's like, no, guys, there's something wrong with you guys if you got this. So it was like, it's such a unique perspective, you know, but so well packaged and so well delivered, you know. So in many ways, I think what's going to start happening, the more, because we're so connected and we are part of a global community, what's going to start happening is that comedians, obviously, they're going to perform in terms of what's in front of them locally, but they're going to start finding ways to bridge the gap.
Mm-hmm.
And with more comedians that go out there and start making it, you know, themselves, it will just, guys will start realizing that we can do this. So, for example, Luis Ogola is on his way. Like, I was with him in Canada, like at the biggest comedy festival in Canada, and everyone was talking about this kid, you know?
They were just like,
wow. And I mean, we all know it's taken 15 years for him to get
Luis,
there. But when they're there, they're just like, so there's more. Here's another South African comedian who's world class, you know? So that is the wave. It's already started. And by the time people go into Anne Kansiime's YouTube page, and even if you're struggling to understand her accent or you're like, this comedy is so crazy, but now there's like...
She won some YouTube views, 2 million views. She won YouTube awards.
You can't deny the power of her comedy.
And that million views is not coming from Uganda or East Africa. It's literally globally.
Because
by the time YouTube is like, look, we need to give you credit.
Let me put
you
it this way. Wherever Anne the world. Travels in Africa, sells out. Straight.
She's crazy,
But she's built that herself. And she's built it from a truth, you know, just about being African. And everybody, you know, who watches across the continent connects and relates with her, not because they're Ugandan, but because of the African, you know, the narrative that, you know,
underpins everything. Don't say African-nacity again. please. That's not, those aren't the ones who pay us. We're actually going to have to delete that. Because I'm with the Africa Connected crew.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
So just in before we let you go, just real quick. This is a serious question, and I'm trying to find a way of phrasing it. You can answer it, you can not answer it if you don't want to. So there are obviously certain African countries that where currently people don't have the freedom of speech or the freedom of comedy, shall I say.
Yeah.
You know, there's one country in East Africa, I won't say the name of the country, you know, where as much as it is a democracy, so to speak, people know that as a comedian and as a person, you can't speak out against the current administration.
Yeah.
You know, and we see this happening in different parts, so North Africa and so forth. Mm. What are your thoughts around politics and how it perhaps hinders, you know, or how would you make the case for these benevolent dictators?
Sure.
How would you make the case for these benevolent dictators or to these benevolent dictators about why they should be allowing there to be a comedy space even within these worlds that they've, they've created?
Well, for starters, I think, let me start even, you know, before going to the sort of comedy elements of it all. But comedy is art. And what is art? Art is expression. You cannot stop it. You know, art has existed ever since, you know, and art has survived all of the dictators of this world.
All of them.
You can name them.
They even become our friends. We even love them. They are memes now.
Like, you know what I mean? So comedy is art and art is expression. You cannot stop expression for as long as people have, you know, an ability to think for themselves and, you know, speak or whatever it is. You cannot. So for me, that's how I've always seen it. And it's bigger than just the jokes, right? Then second thing is that, I kind of feel because of the unique African, you know, situation, comedy is even more important on this continent than probably anywhere else, in my opinion. Because of all the things we've already spoken about, you know, it gives people a voice and, you know, their opinions and their feelings to be expressed. I actually, so I've got a brand called Stand Up Africa, which I started in 2011, you know, and it was because I could see there was comedy happening all over the continent. But at that time, comedy was happening in West Africa. Comedy was happening in pockets, East Africa and Central Africa and Southern Africa, but it was never connected. And yet, it was, there were so many similarities. So I basically did this show where I basically booked all the top comedians on the continent on one lineup. And we were all amazed by the result. We all realized how much we are connected as Africans through our struggles, through the journeys we've traveled and all that kind of stuff. And I actually want to, one of these days, I actually want to do a documentary on comedy in Africa called Stand Up Africa, and just about how comedy in the face of, you know, dictatorships and oppression and all that, comedians have continued to, like, it's that whole the rose that grew from concrete type vibes, you know what I mean? Comedians are still out there, you know, and speaking truth to power and taking risks and gambles, and because it's something that's in them. They can't stop being themselves. So, for example, there's a guy called Carl Joshua Ngube from Zimbabwe, for example, and he pretty much like Zimbabwe's real first professional comedian, right? And he has stories about it became all his shows, the secret police used to book the middle four row, seats in the show, always. And he started booking those seats, like blocking them for those guys. And if those seats were occupied, he knew the secret police was in there. If those seats were not occupied, then there weren't any secret. And he used to tone his show accordingly.
Depending.
And the first 10-15 minutes of his set would be about those four guys. And he would be like, okay, guys, let's assess what I can or cannot say. And he would literally, so guys, can I talk about religion today? No? okay, how much can I talk about? Like, and it became part of the thing. But he learned how to manage it. Basket Mouth has grown his career while there's military juntas that run Nigeria. And the military are hardcore. But he was doing comedy through that. And those military rulers have come and gone. And he's still there.
And come again.
You know what I mean? So, in many ways, like, I don't think it's unstoppable. They won't, you know, but what we can do as in terms of everyone, you know, whether we're in the media or we're in the back end of production or management or whatever, is to continue to like support these comedians and put them on and, you know, and they'll lead the way.
They'll lead the way. Thank you so much for spending time with us on Africa State of Mind. We actually have to wrap it up because the next group of people is walking in the studio. They're like knocking on the door, like knock, knock, knock. But it's been really awesome. Congratulations on everything that you have done. Cool. Talking to you is enlightening.
Awesome. Thank you.
It's quite funny. I mean, I don't know why I'm not a comedian yet, but that's okay. You know,
that's fine. A story for another day.
That's a story for another day. We all remember how horrible I was on Pierre Minati's show. But thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Lee.
Cool. Thanks so much for listening to another episode of Africa State of Mind. I hope that you enjoy listening to this podcast as much as we enjoy putting it together for you. And once again, a big shout out to all of the amazing people from around the amazing continent of Africa, you know, who are really doing their part with regards to changing the narrative. Don't forget that you can interact with us on our Twitter handle at Africa State Mind. You can also join the Africa State of Mind group on Facebook. And please remember to rate us on iTunes. Let us know how it is that you think that we're doing. And if you have any ideas for any guests or people from your particular country within the continent of Africa that are really changing the narrative, please be sure to share it with us. That's all we have for time for today. My name is Lee Kasumba, Africa State of Mind. We'll be back next week with another great episode.
Africa State of Mind with Lee Kasumba. Get it on iTunes now.